First, many of the diseases that have made headlines in recent years have gone from wildlife populations to humans, in some cases our livestock. Things like avian flu, MERS, SARS, Ebola. Those are just some of the most recent high-profile examples, and those diseases have gotten a lot of attention from the international health community. But some health experts are saying we should put more effort into detecting these diseases before they make the jump to livestock and to humans.
In a new study published last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, researchers cataloged studies of wildlife illness for the last 100 years and found that a few diseases had gotten lots of scrutiny while others had been more or less ignored. They make the case for an early warning system to get a handle on potential threats.
Wisconsin's own Tony Goldberg studies this sort of thing. He's a professor of epidemiology in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine and associate director for research at the UW-Madison Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Nice to be here.
So what do you think of this idea? Maybe this isn't new, I suppose, but trying to detect wildlife diseases in the wild before they can make the jump to us and our livestock.
Well, you're right. The idea isn't new, but it's really important. And this has been an idea that has been taking off in the last decade or so. Some people call it pandemic prevention. So the idea is that it's much more efficient and cost-effective to find diseases that might make the jump before they actually do.
And how do you go about doing that? How do you actually flag a pathogen, a disease, before it makes a jump as something? How do you know it's a threat at all to begin with versus when it's more benign?
That's a great question, and therein lies the controversy. It's not entirely clear. There are groups, including my own lab, that are doing modern versions of what you might call virus hunting, where we go out into nature, we sample animals, we sample the environment, and we do comprehensive assessments of the viruses that are in there. And then we look at their genomes and say, well, this looks like something that has jumped in the past. Maybe it's a threat in the future. That's one way. But I personally don't think that's enough. I think that if you really think about what makes people and animals exchange diseases, it's not just the characteristics of the bugs, of the viruses, of the bacteria, but it's how they're interacting. So I've always said we need to have a complementary approach that focuses on ecology to understand how people interact with wildlife and how wildlife interact with livestock to understand what's going on.
So once we've gone out there and found something and said, okay, we're going to flag this. This could be a problem. It could make the jump based on what it is, what it looks like, how we interact with it. What do we do with that information? How do we make it so that it doesn't make that jump?
Again, that's an excellent question, and there's controversy around that too. The standard response is monitoring. So if we know it's there, we can look for it and continue to look for it and monitor sick people in the area for it and check to see that it hasn't made the jump. If we're really concerned about it, we can erect barriers to keep people away from livestock or improve education to tell people, or I'm sorry, wildlife, or improve education to tell people that this is a potential risk, they should stay away. But it's a balancing act because you also don't want to cry wolf when it's not necessary.
Well, what do you think about this approach of looking at the intersection of human beings and livestock or wildlife and livestock, using livestock as sort of the common denominator? It doesn't seem as though a ton of attention has been focused there in the past. Is that a good place to start?
That is a good place to start. So we tend to focus, being humans, on diseases that humans get. And diseases that people get from animals are called zoonoses. And diseases that animals get from people are called anthropenoses or reverse zoonoses. But there's actually no equivalent term for diseases that one species of animal gets from another species of animal. There's no, you know, wildlife OCs or livestock OCs term. So because we're mainly concerned about human health, and that's where a lot of the money is, we haven't looked as extensively as we should at the wildlife-livestock interface, which is the topic of the article you mentioned, and which is a very nebulous thing. I mean, it's everywhere where we have livestock. We see it in Wisconsin on dairy farms where we drive by and we see deer in the pastures. We see it in Africa where people are carving roads into remote areas to conduct agriculture and mining. So this is all around us, and yet that particular interaction, wildlife and livestock, has been very understudied.
So what determines how likely a disease is to jump from one animal to another, whether one of those animals is a human or not? Is this, you know, evolutionary common ground? The more similar we are, I guess I could think of exceptions to that right away. What is it that makes a bug flexible, omnivorous?
Yeah, no, that's a great question too. And there, and you know, frustratingly, there is no one answer. You mentioned evolutionary closeness of the hosts, that's certainly a factor. We do share a number of diseases with non-human primates. The AIDS virus, for example, originated as a chimpanzee virus. But there are plenty of examples of diseases that jump into humans from things that are not our closest relatives, such as avian influenza. So it seems to be a combination of three things. Yes, how similar the hosts are, how the two hosts actually interact in the real world. Are they, you know, shaking hands and sneezing on each other, or are they just looking at each other across a fence? And then the third thing is just plain luck. There are certain viruses that have latched on to certain ways of making a living. They've targeted certain receptors, or they've evolved certain mechanisms of replication that just by chance make them capable of infecting humans. And that probably is just sort of a lottery ticket sort of thing.
Now, birds, you mentioned avian flu. Birds seem like a particularly worrisome vector because they fly all over the world in some cases. You look at some species of cranes, or at least maybe they fly around the country. Is that a good place to start looking in birds, just because of the transmission?
Birds are extremely important. Yeah, there are two examples that spring immediately to mind. The first is West Nile virus. That's a bird virus. And that, historically, we've known it's infected birds in Africa and the Middle East. And when it came here, it has become endemic in birds in North America, and that's what perpetuates the virus here. The other is what you're alluding to, which is avian influenza, which its natural hosts are migratory birds, particularly waterfowl, and they really migrate. I mean, we're about to see the coming of the southward migratory birds through Madison, and with them they bring all their pathogens from wherever they've been. And on their way, there are farms of domestic birds, and that's where we think the problem is. So, birds are an issue because they fly, and because they do have this history of hosting these pathogens that can become established in new places.
We're talking to Tony Goldberg. He's an epidemiologist at the UW-Madison, looking at efforts to try to catch wildlife diseases before they make the jump to humans or to our livestock. Well, I understand you are doing some wildlife virus and bacteria collection here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us what you're up to?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So, you know, we tend to think of these issues as happening in faraway jungles where, you know, things are going crazy and there's logging, but it's happening right here in Wisconsin. I think many people will remember the monkeypox outbreak of many years ago, where it was imported animals that led to the introduction of that virus into Wisconsin. But right now, we're working on a number of issues right here in Wisconsin. One of them is a virus that was introduced into our fish populations about 10 years ago, called viral hemorrhagic septicemia virus. And that was, up until then, a marine fish virus that somehow got into the Great Lakes and evolved to be able to infect a large number of Wisconsin fishes, including some of our most prized sport fish like bass and muskellunge. So it caused quite a stir. There were trade embargoes. There were all sorts of USDA-imposed restrictions. So we've been studying how that virus managed to get a foothold and how it's persisting in Wisconsin's lakes. And that's, you know, not a human health issue, but it's certainly an economic issue because Wisconsin's recreational fisheries are an enormous portion of our state's economy. And then sometimes my lab gets the odd case or two from strange mystery diseases. So the one that we have been working on for the past few years was an orangutan that unexpectedly died in the Milwaukee County Zoo. And we managed, through these types of molecular sleuthing technologies, to identify it as a completely unknown species of parasite related to known tapeworms. So it was a total red herring. No one would ever have guessed it. There was nothing that the zoo or anyone could have done to prevent it. But it just illustrates that we don't have to go to the ends of the earth to find these potentially new pathogens that could emerge.
Well, obviously, you're trying to find these pathogens before they jump from animals to humans. So I'm not asking you to be alarmist, but is there anything out there that you're watching right now that you think could potentially be worrisome?
There's several. And one I'll mention that's been interesting collaboration with my colleagues at the Wisconsin National Primate Research Center has been a relatively obscure virus called simian hemorrhagic fever virus. And that sounds really
scary.
That
doesn't sound good.
It doesn't sound good at all. But it's a virus that is in a family that is not known to infect people. And yet, in the Cold War era, it caused major mortality events in space monkeys in the U.S. and the Soviet Union. For years and years and years and years, nobody knew where it came from. Well, my team was the first to discover a wild animal that has a virus of this type. And since we did that about in 2011, we've discovered 12 of the 13 known variants of this virus by screening monkeys from across Africa using the technologies we developed. And what we see is a virus that's very diverse, both within its hosts, it generates a lot of mutants, and between hosts, it's very diverse. It's highly prevalent, it replicates to very high levels in monkeys, and it infects monkey populations that interact with people. So, you know, I don't know if it can make the jump. Maybe we're lucky and it can't latch onto our cells in the proper way, but it has all the hallmark features of something we should be watching.
You say hemorrhagic, which sounds like Ebola. Are they connected?
They are clinically very similar, but they are very distantly related to each other evolutionarily. So, yeah, it looks a lot like Ebola in a monkey, but it's a completely different viral family that, again, is not known to infect humans, and we're not working on the live virus here in Wisconsin.
Tony, this sounds like you're hunting for the ultimate needle in a haystack here, but are we at a point where in the next 5 or 10 years, this is actually something that's going to help us avoid horrible diseases spreading to our animals and to us?
I think it will help. What we're likely to come up with in the next decade is a pretty comprehensive list of the viruses that are lurking around in mammals across the world that interact with people, especially non-human primates, bats, rodents, these things that we already know are disease reservoirs. The question is, even if we had that comprehensive list, could we predict which of those will make the jump? I think that's not going to be feasible in the near future. For that, we're going to need much more sophisticated ways of understanding from the structure of a virus and the ecology how likely it is to actually make that jump into people.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine and associate director for research at the UW-Madison Global Health Institute.